And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your hospitably genial host, John Derbyshire, with, as we promised last week, a Radio Derb special. Yes, our esteemed proprietor and dear leader, Taki Theodorakopoulos, took a break from cruising here in the Aegean and came ashore to visit us. We treated him to an excellent lunch of grilled octopus, goat burgers, and galactoburrico, all washed down with some of the excellent local ouzo. Then, at my request, Taki graciously agreed that we could leave the mic open as we chatted here in the studio. This week's podcast is some edited highlights from our conversation. What I mostly edited out was myself. You hear quite enough of my voice in a regular week's Radio Derb. This week, I wanted you to hear what Taki had to say. Just one note about the timing here. In last week's podcast, I anticipated that Taki would be dropping by this week. In fact, he came ashore last Friday, May 29th, just a few hours too late to speak to us in last week's show. We took the opportunity to record him anyway, but bear in mind that the recording is from May 29th, so there is some slight loss in topicality. One more apologetic note, there is some faint extraneous noise in the background. The studio air conditioning was misbehaving and all the technicians had gone home. Sorry about that. Okay, over to the man himself. Taki, you're the author of a rather good book, my wife liked it very much, called Nothing to Declare. And many of our listeners perhaps are not aware of that. Oh, could you tell us something about that book? How did it come about? What does it mean, Nothing to Declare?
The book was published in 1990, 91, both in America, Atlantic Grove in America, and Simon & Schuster in England. Got the best reviews. I've never had a bad review. It was my diary, having done 3-4 months in prison for carrying 2 grams of cocaine through Heathrow. It got terrific reviews, but even The Guardian gave it a very good review. It didn't sell at all. I don't know why. And the title was sort of suggested to me by a friend because I hadn't declared the 2 grams of coke. And the reason I didn't declare them was because it was illegal to carry 2 grams of coke. Although, in parts of Europe, if you get caught with 2 grams, it's all right because it means that it's for personal use. Nevertheless, it was good for me. I spent 4 months in Pentonville. I didn't have a drink for 4 months. I trained every day, and I wrote a good book, which had wonderful reviews, and as I said, it didn't sell at all. Now, Harvey Weinstein, my NBF, that means new best friend, took me to lunch a couple of weeks ago with Michael Mailer, and who's a producer, a very good close friend of mine, and asked to read the book, and he wanted to do a picture of it. And I said, Mickey Rooney is dead. He can't play young Taki. And Bela Lugosi is also dead. He can't play old Taki. He was laughing. Most of you, of your listeners won't know who Bela Lugosi or Mickey Rooney are, except for a certain age. Anyway, so we don't know what's going to happen. Maybe he'll do something about it. Maybe he won't. I really don't care because my family is appalled that they would make a film about this happened 35 years ago, by the way.
Yes.
32 years ago, sorry.
Do you have any advice for the younger generation in the event they should find themselves in a jail?
Well, jails are much... when I went to Pentonville, it was a Victorian jail. You had to slop out. Slopping out means there are no loos, there's no toilet, there's no wash basin or anything like that in your cell. You use a potty, and in the morning, while other people are brushing their teeth, you empty it and wash it. When I was in jail, I read Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, and it amused me that he used to take a shower before breakfast every morning in a California jail. While I was in a Victorian jail, we took a shower once a week, although I took one every day because I got the best job in the gym, in the whole nick, as they call it. I was a gym orderly, and I trained all day, and I got it through other means. if I have the time, can I tell you how I got it?
Yes,
I was going very slowly sewing buttons the first day for the army, and one of the screws, as they call them, said, you're slagging, you're going to be sent to the punishment block. And I said, look, I'm terribly sorry, sir, but I dress at Anderson and Shepherd. I really don't know how to sew buttons. So he said to me, did you rob Anderson and Shepherd, who's the number one tailor in England? I said, I didn't rob Anderson and Shepherd. I dressed there. He said, well, I happen to work part-time there. He was working for... And I'll check it. I said, well, ask Mr. Halsey about it. Ask Halsey about it. So anyway, he goes to Halsey. And Halsey, who's my fitter and who I'd given a very nice ride on my boat in Mykonos, he was a very gay man, said, Mr. Tyke is not only one of our best clients, he's definitely our nicest clients. Do anything you can for him. Otherwise, there'll be no place for you at Anderson Shepherd. So the screw came back. His name was Robinson. He said, what job do you want? I said, I want the gym. He said, well, you're lucky because there's an opening. So I got the gym. So in other words, if you treat your tailor right, next time you're in jail, you might get the best job. Today, my advice to anybody going to jail today is just don't go. Because it's not so uncomfortable and so horrible as it used to be. And people are not afraid of jail anymore, especially in Europe. I mean, in Sweden, it's like a country club. In England, well, less so.
Isn't it the case in England and France that they're full of Muslims now?
Now it's full of Muslims, and you will have trouble there, although they try to separate it. Speaking of Muslims, you know, we stopped them twice in tours in 7:80 or 7:30.
Charles Martel.
Then we stopped him in 1683. Jean Sobieski, the Poles came down, saved Vienna. And this, the third time, they won because they've done it, they did it surreptitiously through asylum seekers. Instead of attacking us with our cavalry, and they've attacked us through millions of people. There's a million Libyans waiting as we speak to come to Europe, to come to Greece or Italy or France, and to be absorbed by a continent that's already extremely crowded. It's tiny compared to America. And we had 220,000 asylum seekers alone last year. Not a single one has been sent back because the laws of the EU, which is the greatest kleptocracy and undemocratic body that's ever existed, the EU says every single asylum seeker will be given the chance to prove his case. Of course, not a single one has ever been sent back. Everybody's an asylum seeker, and everybody who comes over says, I would be murdered, killed if I go back. Well, in Africa, people are killed every day. In the Middle East, people are killed every day. And only 2 days ago, one of those vice presidents for life, Timmermans is his name, I suspect he's a German, said,
In the EU, said
there's not a single African who shouldn't be given the chance to come to Europe as long as he's an asylum seeker. What does that mean? Then they're trying to get the navies of various countries to stop the smugglers who bring those unfortunate souls over, to stop them at the beginning. Well, this won't happen because they cannot go near Libya because the Libyans will fire on them. The EU is so, so completely, their hands are tied to regulations that they have imposed themselves. You cannot do anything unless you have 28 countries approving of it. They have no arms, they have no navy, expecting the Italian navy or the Greek navy to intercept those unfortunate souls who, of course, pay everything they have in the world to the smuggler to put them on board and bring them over. It's just a joke. And people continue. I mean, in Sweden is almost more than 10% Muslim. Norway is the only country that's kept them out. My country is over 10% Muslim. And they're now, a week alone, 32,000 snuck in because the police haven't been paid. The border guards haven't been paid, so they went home. So they came pouring in. Italy is the worst case, of course, because they all come to Lampedusa, and from there they go up. If you go to Milano train station, the Venetian train station, or Rome train station, three beautiful edifices by themselves, the train stations do not make for beautiful buildings, all you see is people sleeping, Africans. And they're all, of course, asylum seekers, because Eritrea, which is a very repressive regime, Mali, all those countries next to
Niger, Nigeria. Yeah.
I mean, here's Nigeria, the wealthiest, richest country in the world as far as minerals are concerned, and they import oil, which they export because they have no refineries.
Yeah.
They have refineries which don't work because all the parts have been stolen. So if Africa, which is the most biggest hellhole in the world, and the most, the cruelest continent ever, we are importing those people, and of course, most of them are Muslims. Most of them will, once they come over, will insist on no-go areas. There are no-go areas in London where homosexuals are not allowed to walk through or drink. Mm-hmm. Now, I find that amazing. I'm not a big pro-gay man, and I'm certainly against gay marriage of two men. And yet, I think every gay man has the right to walk through, if he's an Englishman, through parts of London. Well, he won't be allowed because they're Muslim areas and they don't allow it. They don't allow drinking. I love booze, but I don't like all those English people you see passed out vomiting on the sidewalk. Nevertheless, it's their right to do it. But I don't see any of the feminists in America complaining about the Islamists doing that in European cities.
And as sorry as we may feel for the Syrians,
of course,
who now Obama wants to bring 2,000 over before the end of this fiscal year here, as sorry as we may feel for them, the great majority are Muslims, and there are 49, count them, 49 majority Muslim nations in the world, some of them very wealthy. Why is it up to us?
They will not take them in because people still do not realize, as our great intrepid leader George W. Bush didn't know at the start of that disastrous attack on Iraq 13 years ago, they didn't know that this is a war of tribes and a war between Sunnis and Shiites. And Iraq and Syria means nothing. The whole thing started in Syria because the Saudis wanted Assad down because he's an Alawite, an offshoot of the Shiite, who kept the peace, protected the Christians, protected the Druze, and they decided after Gaddafi fell that Assad was the next person. This is all the work of our friends, our brothers in Washington, D.C., the neocons, who think of only one thing, Israel. And as you can see, Israel is far better off today than it was 3 years ago, because the whole place is a chaos. The whole Middle East is a raging chaos, which makes Israel's safety much more valid.
I was quietly wondering if the Israelis were helping to supply ISIS. It seemed to me that would be in their interest to do so.
Absolutely.
Because they regard Shia Iran as the big enemy.
Exactly. And I'm not, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Saudi money and Israeli know-how is in there. Because ISIS is fighting very well, and they weren't fighting well. I think something, we will eventually find out who's behind ISIS, because...
Well, I did ask Norm Friedman, who's a military, very very good high-level military analyst, about my little suspicion there. I had dinner with him a few days ago, and he said, to the best of his knowledge, no, they weren't doing that.
Maybe Mr. Friedman is wrong. My suspicion, I have no proof, my suspicion is that Israel is up to its knees involved in there, with know-how, with advice, with weapons, which they get from the Americans, and I think the Saudis. Just look what the Saudis have done. The Saudis buy all our advanced weaponry. They attacked Yemen, and they've managed to kill, since then, 3,000 innocent. They hit refugee camps with absolutely no guns or rebels inside of them. So who's doing all that? how come suddenly ISIS has become so strong? You know, I'm very, very suspicious.
Do you think, we know the Russians are involved because they have that big naval base in Syria. So they're involved in propping up the Assad regime. How do you feel about Russia's place? How do you feel about Putin? You like Putin?
I'm very much an admirer of Putin, however horrible it might sound. In fact, I'm waiting to hear from somebody who keeps promising, and we keep sending him all sorts of goodies. He keeps promising that I can get on the judo mat with Putin because he knows I've always backed him. Look, it's very simple. Russia has always needed either a very strong president, a very strong czar, or a very strong dictator. Putin is nothing like the Soviet dictators were. Putin is a strong authoritarian figure on the line of the great Franco or Salazar, I would say. Most important thing that people don't realize, especially the Americans, is that Russia has no natural borders, no natural barriers. Like America has two oceans, one called Atlantic, the other called Pacific.
Ah, I remember and, that.
Yes, you remember those two old lakes. And of course, they get attacked by from the southern hemisphere through Mexico. But Russia doesn't have that. So they have always to extend their borders to keep a, what do you call those lines between, so Ukraine for them, Bismarck said in his time that Russia without Ukraine is no Russia. So if Bismarck said it, who was thinking of attacking there, it shows how important Ukraine is to Russia. And when the EU, the most useless institution I know of, started to tell the Ukrainians, a nation that didn't exist before 1919, start to make noises toward them, come and join us, we'll do this for you, you will do that, it showed how stupid the Ukrainian leaders were to believe anything the EU. What can the EU do for the Ukraine? Nothing. Just impose austerity the way they did in Greece. So Putin was right to interfere. And we, as President Nixon had said at the time, and of course the famous diplomat who sent the 5,000-word telegram, the great American...
Kennan?
George F. Kennan, we have to embrace them, stick out our hand, extend our friendly hand instead of, they've turned Putin into, I mean, late night television, you always talk about Putin as if he were Stalin, as if he were Hitler.
Mm.
Putin is a nationalist who has brought back the Christian religion to Russia, who backs him up and is a strong leader and has 82%. Bring me somebody who has 82% approval ratings in Europe or in America.
What do you know anything about the demography there? It always used to be said after the Soviet Union fell that Russia's demography was cratering. They weren't making any babies. I didn't think to check on this. I have a dim memory of seeing something a couple of weeks ago that the fertility rate in the Russian Federation is now up.
Well, it's going up a little bit. I don't know, have exact details, but it went bad for a while after Perestroika. Too many people were drinking, Soviet Union broke up and all that. But, you know, the Soviets like to drink, and people who like to drink like to also women. And I think it's starting to catch up again. Because, you know, they were close to 400 million, then they got down to less than 300.
Less than 200,
yeah. And so now, we're, you know, not in our generation, John, but in the next generation, the Russians will be back.
Okay, good. Well, I hope it's the good Russians, not the bad Russians.
No, the good Russians will prevail. And I love the way they love their religion, and I love the way they love their country. You know, very few, except for all the oligarchs who are mostly Jewish and never had a home, they never felt at home in Russia because of their religion. Most of them, Russians stay home.
Mm.
And when I see them, because I see them in Europe, the tourists and all that, they speak no known language. They look very Russian, and I wear a cross, and the only thing they look at you is when you have a cross, and they cross themselves the way we Greeks do, from left to right, from right to left, and I just like them. I like the simple Russians. I like the athletes and the workers, the oligarchs, are obviously, like oligarchs all over the world, except for one more thing, they have the worst manners in the world. They make hedge fund managers in America seem like old-fashioned gentlemen.
Yes, who is this oligarch who just bought the I think it was the highest price,
yes,
house,
Whittenhurst
in England,
North London, Whittenhurst. Yeah. He's good, Gurdjieff. He was a small timer and he did it with mirrors as they do, and it's not 100% sure. He happens to be one of the few Christian oligarchs, and he did it with, he obviously. You know, he pulled some number with some factories up there. He took over from Khodorkovsky.
Uh-huh, yes.
That's what he did. And he seems to be a very... He dresses badly. He looks like he was a very nondescript fellow. Mm. And, it makes for a change because I'm used to those horrible... I live next to this man, the king of shit.
I'm sorry, the king of shit?
Yeah.
Is that a place?
Fertilizer, the king of shit. Fertilizer. He has all the fertilizer in the world. And he's ruined my life in New York because he's building something enormous next to where I live. And he's ruined my life in Stade by pledging 90 million euros, Swiss francs, to build a art center. He speaks no known language and he bought Scorpios, the old Onassis private island. He looks pretty poorly when you see him, but thank God he doesn't speak any language except Russian.
I must say I've always had a soft spot for the Russians. I did a Russian course at college. The only thing I can remember how to say in Russian is "Жизнь прожить не более перейти".
Well, this has something to do with good health?
No. It means to go through life is not to walk across a field. I'm not quite sure what it means.
What does that mean?
It's one of those cryptic things. Yeah. It's like Khalil Gibran or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Well, I remember when John O'Sullivan took me just after the wall came down, and the Russians were sort of splitting up. We went to a place in Brooklyn, and I had a stretch limo, and we piled in. We went there to serve 9 courses. And they were, so I was laughing, I was very drunk, and there was this woman with gold teeth, and she was dancing with a man straight out of Raskolnikov, all in black, looking very white and very funereal like that, very good looking like that. So I cut in on him, started dancing with her, she was smiling and all this, and he came back. Anyway, to make a long story short, he lost his temper, challenged me to go outside, we walked outside, I was in a good mood, I was drunk, she was ugly, fat woman with gold teeth. I was just doing to bother him. Then he saw this long stretch limo and he said to me, "You drug dealer?" I said, "No, I'm not a drug dealer." He said, "You have big car." I said, I don't want your woman. I'm just joking. Oh, he said, "You can have my woman." I just saw in him how the Russians respect authority or wealth. I mean, he was a very good looking man who was obviously a doorman somewhere. But then when I asked the band, the band never stopped. I said to him, "How can you play for 3 hours straight? What coke are you on?" They said, "Coke? No, we are Russians." In other words, we're here to suffer.
Yeah.
They're like that. So they're good people.
You know, Putin's latest beef with us is this business of Russia getting the Soccer World Cup. In 2018. And that his getting the World Cup has coincided with this scandal about the FIFA executive.
Exactly. Well, this is the biggest scandal ever, but it's not. Russia deserves the World Cup because Russia has had football, as they call it, soccer over here, football in Europe. Football has always been very big in Russia, and they deserved it as they got the Olympics in 1980, and we boycott them, but they had a great Olympics, they had a great Winter Olympics in Sochi, they'll have a great World Cup. The biggest scandal of all, and we've always known it, my father had a first division, a premier division football team in Greece, is the Sepp Blatter and all those crooks, from most of them from the Caribbean, most of them black, most of them, all of them on the take, and they gave it to Qatar. Now how you can... Already 1,000 Nepalese have died trying to build stadiums in that sandy hellhole. How you can give the 2022 football world football tournament, world championship, to a desert? This is unheard of. The money that the Qatar paid is obviously in the billions. They paid everybody off, but it's impossible to find it because they're not as stupid as some of them who took the money and talked. The money was given in, obviously, in numbered accounts in the Cayman Islands or wherever. Nobody said anything, and the Qataris, who have all the money in the world and financed ISIS to begin with, won the 2000. There's only one thing to do, is we have to retract that. In other words, FIFA has to be disbanded, and FIFA has to have a new, the Jordanian man who will not win. The vote is today. The Jordanian prince, who is the nephew of the cousin of the king, should get the presidency, and we have to clean. It's the most corrupt institution except for the EU. I would say there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars because of all the sponsors who pay millions to be represented in football tournaments, and they only run the world every 4 years, the World Cup.
Right.
But they have a kitty of maybe a couple of billion.
It's an obvious target for corruption. Now, why isn't that the case with the International Olympic Committee? Or is it the case?
Well, the International Olympic Committee, for somehow, because for so many years, the man they all love to hate, and who I admired more than anybody, Avery Brundage, kept it clean. And even Samaranch, I mean, I know it's a strange thing, but in all the world championships, I take part in judo. I've never won with a blue gi, because they changed it for blue and white for television, and I've never lost with a white gi. Now, why this should happen to me, because they did it for television, the Olympics, sure, there's corruption in the Olympics, but much less, much less. Nothing compared to FIFA. FIFA is the most corrupt. It's fraud upon fraud upon fraud, and they have 2 billion to play with, and they have a kleptocrat at the head, Sepp Blatter, who refuses to give any accounts to anybody because they're self-perpetuating. They vote themselves in. 14 people who decide. Mm. And, of course, we tried like hell. You can't infiltrate it. And that there, a country should step in, the UN, the US, as it did, and arrested some of the crooks in Zurich last week.
What do you make of this news from Baltimore that the police are sitting in the donut shop apparently?
I was so amazed. The paradox is that the man who has saved more black lives has not been Sharpton, or the mayor of Baltimore, who's black, or the state prosecutor, who's black, has been their their bête noire, Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, a white conservative New York mayor, by applying the broken window theories, has saved more black lives, because you never see, when there's a black who gets murdered, and they get murdered every day by another black, you never see Sharpton going there to commiserate with a victim's family. You never see the TV cameras. They never come in with CNBC and all those others phony, pretending to be neutral television stations or press or magazines or newspapers. What you see is Giuliani, by applying those things, and you have to have stop and search. And look at New York. The moment de Blasio stopped it, the crime rate has risen by 65%. Shootings are up, murders are up, and they will continue to go up unless the police disproportionately attacks high crime areas. And that means stopping and searching and sending policemen. Don't forget, most of the police in Baltimore is black. So we don't hear it. The way it's presented, you think the police brutality comes from white people. Well, it doesn't. It comes from cops who are completely outnumbered by criminals in Baltimore and have their hands tied. It's a joke. And I attribute all this to the media, who refuse they excuse the looters, and they call them rioters. They're not rioters. They're looters, professional looters, who will go and try to enrich themselves the moment somebody gets shot by a policeman who is already under attack by another. I mean, it's such a joke when I see that, when you hear that, all those people. You've had two or three dubious cases, but the thousands of people that the police save all over this country, you never hear about. You only hear about when there is an accident, as it was with Freddie Gray, who was a career criminal, of course. His name sounds like a nice young college boy, but anyway.
I agree with you about Giuliani, but let's give a little credit to Michael Bloomberg, too.
That's true.
I happen to know the numbers. Mm-hmm. When Giuliani came in New York City, there were a bit less than 2,000 homicides a year.
Yeah.
When he left in the end of 2001, it was down to 630-something.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Bloomberg came in and did three terms, as you remember.
Yeah.
And when he left, it was down at 330-something.
Absolutely.
So two good, business-like, in matters of social order, conservative mayors saved an awful lot of lives. You're absolutely right.
They did, and Bloomberg, of course, did. But, you know, he stuck by his commissioner, Kelly, who was great. And de Blasio is not sticking by Bratton, who's also very good. But, you know, if you don't, when you have people like Sharpton who owe $4 million to the IRS and they won't pay, and yet President Obama is seen next to him, embracing him, what do you expect? When you have race hustlers like Sharpton forming the agenda.
About the referendum in Ireland.
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
On homosexual marriage, what do you think of that time?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very surprised, although they knew it was coming, because everybody, starting with the world's probably most unpleasant man, as far as I'm concerned, his face looks just like a penis. His name is Marr, Bill Marr. He's on HBO. He was
delighted. Oh, I know. Yes.
Awful, horrible man. Anyway, he was delighted in saying. Now, I was surprised because a Catholic nation like Ireland, nevertheless, look, it's their country, they can do what they like, and everybody's free to vote. But what is very important to know is that there are two gays who are almost professional gays because they do everything. They give only to professional causes. They live in New York. They have hotels, and they have gay bars, gay hotels, and only give to gay causes. Because they don't do anything else except read the gay news, gave a lunch or a party, which they called a fundraiser, which it wasn't, they both tried, for Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is against same-sex marriage, and, of course, they were targeted by the gay liberation, whatever they're called.
Activists,
and they have called for a boycott. These people have gone on radio, they had a big article in the New York Times 2 days ago begging for forgiveness, saying, we didn't know, we'll do anything you want. They say, too late. In other words, when the gay activists target you, they can be extremely, extremely effective, and they can ruin your life. I mean, Elton John asked for a boycott of somebody who made a funny remark, who also happens to be gay. He asked for a worldwide boycott of Dolce & Gabbana. And they had to apologize, of course, immediately. But how can people ask for a boycott, celebrities ask for a boycott, and then the gay activists go after you just because you happen to exercise your own free will and manage, just you stated your free opinion?
It's the intolerance that
intolerance
gets to me.
Well, the gay lobby is extremely intolerant, you know. You might say it's payback because of all those years they didn't have a say, but that doesn't stop the fact that we're supposed to be living in a free society where everybody's allowed to say anything.
I can remember some of those years, as I'm sure you can.
Sure.
I remember them in Britain when homosexuality was still... homosexual acts were criminal.
Yeah, were criminal.
There was actually a great deal of tolerance. Homosexuals were only prosecuted, by and large, if they made a nuisance of themselves,
yeah,
you know, exactly. Public lavatories, things like
yeah.
that. But in my little, rather conservative country town in England in the 1960s, we knew who homosexuals were.
Of course.
You made jokes behind their backs, yeah. but nobody bothered them.
Never.
We were much more tolerant of them
yeah.
than they are now, with cases like Brendan Eich at Mozilla being forced out of his position and these bakers being forced to shut down their businesses.
Their business or any Christian.
We never did that to them back in those,
never.
Scare quote, intolerant times.
Intolerant. I remember in boarding school, we had at Salisbury, we had one of the teachers, behind his back, we call him Homo Bill Thompson, never said anything to us. When Phil Gebhardt, another teacher at Blair, used to come in, we'd say, "Here comes Mr. Gebhardt," and we'd all flee because we're all naked taking showers. And he liked us, we liked him. I remember at my graduation, he almost kissed me, said to me, "Bravo, you made it," because it was touch and go, I was always in trouble. They were very nice people. We were completely tolerant of him, and if we made a joke behind their back, we were kids. But the idea of being targeted now, losing your job because you said, "I happen to be against same-sex marriage," this is straight out of Berlin, 1936, or Moscow, around the same time. This
yeah.
is terrible, and somebody has to have the courage to stand up to these gay Nazis.
And you saw it in the news stories from Ireland in this
yeah.
after this referendum, the triumphalism, the jeering at the losing side.
At the losing side. And it's done by, you know, after all, I remember when they went after Pat Buchanan, when he published the fact, because the gay lobby always said that 10% of the country of America is gay. And when Pat Buchanan came up with irrefutable figures that was only 2%, you know, you never heard from Pat Buchanan again. Slowly, slowly, forget his politics. People went after Pat Buchanan purely for pointing out the truth, that 2% of the country might be gay. Mm. But they're very powerful and very strong, and in businesses that are covered by the press, like the fashion business and the movie business.
Taki, thank you very much for dropping by.
Thank you for having me
on the island.
It's a rare privilege.
The girls would like you to go and join them in a game of beach volleyball, if you don't mind.
I know, I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, good, good,
and
all right.
Can I take my bathing suit off?
You'll have to ask them. Thank you, Taki.
Thank you, John.